Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Alice Bryant, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
Forget what you learned about the Thanksgiving holiday in the United States. It did not begin with the Pilgrims and Indians in 1621, when English settlers invited Native Americans to dinner. And Abraham Lincoln was not the first U.S. president to call for a national day of Thanksgiving. Instead, says historian Penny Coleman, the origins of the holiday are more complex. They are rooted in ancient traditions, one woman's activism, and political and business interests. Coleman wrote the book Thanksgiving, The True Story. She explains that people around the world have held harvest festivals and days of Thanksgiving for centuries. Usually leaders called for a day of Thanksgiving after winning a battle or surviving a difficult time. In 1789, U.S. President George Washington called for a national day of Thanksgiving during his first year in office. He did not say anything about pilgrims and Indians. Instead, he urged Americans to thank God for their new government. Then, in the middle 1800s, Sarah Josepha Hale, a writer and editor, began pressing for a yearly day of Thanksgiving. Hale could see that the country was changing. Families were separating. Some people were moving west, and others were divided over the issue of slavery. At the same time, new immigrants were arriving. Hale wanted all Americans to come together to, in her words, unite as one great family republic. So Hale campaigned for the U.S. government to create a national Thanksgiving holiday on the last Thursday in November. Historian Penny Coleman told VOA some of Hale's reasons. The end of November was the end of the harvest, but also a time when travelers returned home and diseases were fewer. Thursdays were light days for housework, and the country had only two other national holidays, George Washington's birthday in February and Independence Day on the 4th of July. Hale argued that Thanksgiving could honor the work of women, not just political or military success. But in 40 years of letters, articles, and speeches, Coleman says, Hale never said anything about pilgrims and Indians. In 1863, Hale's idea gained the attention of then-President Abraham Lincoln. At the time, the country was in the middle of a civil war. Lincoln likely wanted to use Thanksgiving to unite Americans, Coleman says. The president released a Thanksgiving proclamation for the last Thursday of November. He asked his fellow citizens to thank God, as well as to ask for God's forgiveness. He also remembered widows, mourners, and others who had suffered in the war, but not pilgrims and Indians. Lincoln's declaration did not have the force of law. However, many state governors accepted his call. From then on, a Thanksgiving celebration became a yearly tradition in many parts of the country. However, Thanksgiving was not yet a legal holiday, and it was still not related to pilgrims and Indians. Coleman says that linkage began in the late 1800s. Around this time, The United States was changing again. More immigrants were arriving, many people were poor, and the country was becoming an international power. At the same time, stories about English settlers and Native Americans sharing a Thanksgiving dinner together began appearing in books. Not all the details were the same, the dates were different, and some of the information was not correct. But the general story caught on. Coleman suggests that the story was effective because Americans at the time liked its messages. It was about survival during difficult times. It was about the tests strangers faced in a new place. And it was about kindness, especially the kindness of the English colonists sharing their feast. Coleman's research shows that in the early 1900s, the story was repeated in classrooms, picture books, newspapers, and theaters. Most Americans came to accept the story as the true origin of Thanksgiving. Then, in 1939, Thanksgiving changed. Business leaders noted that, that year, the month of November had 5 Thursdays. They also noted that the day after Thanksgiving marked the beginning of the winter holiday season. So business leaders asked then-President Franklin Roosevelt to move Thanksgiving a week earlier to permit an extra week of Christmas shopping. It was a time of great economic hardship, and Roosevelt agreed. At first, many people objected to the idea of changing the date. Some state lawmakers refused. Finally, the U.S. Congress stepped in. In 1941, they made the fourth Thursday in November, instead of the last, a legal holiday. Historian Penny Coleman says the actual origins of Thanksgiving tell a different story about the holiday than the Pilgrim and Indian version. These origins show what she sees as the three parts of American culture: dynamism, pragmatism, and opportunism. In other words, the supporters of the new holiday believed that things can and do change. Sarah Josepha Hale, especially, gave common sense reasons for her idea. Finally, Lincoln, Roosevelt, and business leaders saw a chance to use the holiday for their own political and financial purposes. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Every year around the Thanksgiving holiday, a strange ceremony happens in Washington, D.C. The president stands outside the White House, gives a brief speech, and then officially pardons a turkey. A pardon is a declaration that someone will not be punished. In this ceremony, President Barack Obama promises not to cook and eat a certain turkey, even though turkeys are the traditional Thanksgiving meal. You might be asking yourself, what is the connection between turkeys, Thanksgiving, and grammar? In today's report, we explore what turkeys can teach you about English verbs. In particular, we will show you how Thanksgiving can teach you to use stative verbs. We will also show you the difference between stative and progressive verbs.
The term stative verb refers to a verb that has a stative meaning. In other words, these verbs show or describe conditions or situations that do not do anything but exist. Verbs that commonly have a stative meaning include verbs that show emotional states, such as love and dislike, verbs that describe sense perceptions, such as smell or taste, verbs that show existence, such as seem or look. In the present tense, a verb with a stative meaning is generally used in its simple form. I love turkey, or Americans like turkey, are two examples. Verbs that have stative meanings are generally not used in the progressive tense. So, you will probably not hear a native speaker say, "I am loving turkey," or "Americans are liking turkey."
Do not fear. We can use our Thanksgiving example to make the point clearer. Imagine you are at an American store. You hear a conversation between a customer and a store employee. The customer wants to buy a turkey that weighs 10 pounds or 4.5 kilograms. Unlike the turkey from the pardoning ceremony, this turkey will have a sad fate, the dinner table. The conversation you hear might go like this.
How much does that turkey weigh?
It weighs 10 pounds.
How much does it cost?
It costs $20.
In the dialogue, you can hear two examples of stative verbs, weigh and cost. The butcher said, "The turkey weighs 10 pounds," and "The turkey costs $20. In both cases, the verbs have a stative meaning. The butcher is describing a condition or situation that simply exists, the weight and cost of the turkey. Now imagine you are eating Thanksgiving dinner with an American family. You might hear any one of the following sentences.
I love turkey.
I dislike turkey.
The turkey smells wonderful.
The food tastes great.
The turkey seems undercooked.
The turkey looks awful.
All these sentences include stative verbs. You might notice that the verbs are also in the simple present form.
So, why would an English speaker not say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," or "I am disliking turkey"? Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber are two English grammar experts. They say that, in general, English speakers use the progressive tense only when the subject of the verb actively controls the state or action. In addition, English speakers generally use the progressive only when the verb describes an action or state that happens over an extended period of time. So, you would not hear an English speaker say, "The turkey is seeming undercooked," because the subject of the verb, the turkey, does not control its state, being undercooked. For the same reason, you would not hear an English speaker say, "I am disliking turkey," because the verb's subject, I, probably does not have control over the action of disliking turkey. Now, some verbs can have stative and progressive meanings. Consider these examples.
The food tastes good.
President Obama is tasting the food.
In the first sentence, the food does not control whether it is good or bad. As a result, the verb taste has a stative meaning because it simply describes the condition of the food. In the second sentence, President Obama is tasting the food, the subject of the verb, President Obama, has control over his action. In addition, the action takes place over an extended period of time. Obama must think about tasting food, then raise the food to his mouth, then consider its quality. So, you could say that the verb taste in this example has a progressive meaning.
The next time you are reading or listening to the news, pay special attention to the verbs. Notice when the progressive form is used and when the simple form is used. Then ask yourself why. Does the verb's subject control the action? Does the action occur over an extended period of time? Or does the verb simply describe a condition that exists? If you are still confused about whether you should use a simple or progressive verb in your own conversations, Conrad and Biber have one tip that might help you. They say that in conversations, English speakers use simple verbs around 120 times in every 1,000 words. Progressive verbs are much less common. They appear fewer than 20 times in every 1,000 words. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The American Civil War in the 1860s was fought not only on land. There was a great deal of fighting between the Union and Confederate navies. This part of the war, the Sea War, is often forgotten, but it was important. The Union victory might not have been possible without the successes of its navy. Many battles took place just off the coast of the United States. Many others took place farther away in international waters. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about the naval side of the Civil War.
As soon as the war started, President Abraham Lincoln wanted to block the South's major ports. He wanted to prevent the South from shipping its agricultural products to other countries in exchange for industrial goods. Lincoln's plan was good, but it had one major weakness. The Union Navy was too small for the job. The Confederate seacoast was long. It extended from Chesapeake Bay to Mexico, a distance of 5,600 kilometers. There were not enough ships in the Union Navy to blockade all of it. Many months would pass before the Union could build up an effective naval force.
The Confederacy had no navy at the start of the Civil War. The Confederate government had little money to create one, and the South had no factories to build one. For a while, the Confederacy was able to get warships from Britain. Then the Union put diplomatic pressure on Britain to stop this support. For the most part, the Confederacy depended on privately owned ships to get goods in and out of the South. About 20 of these private ships flew the Confederate flag. Most were very successful in the beginning. The Florida, for example, captured more than 30 ships before being captured itself off the coast of Brazil in 1864. The Alabama captured more than 60 ships. It was finally sunk in a battle with the Kearsarge off the coast of France. The Shenandoah sailed in the Pacific Ocean. It captured 40 ships. After the war ended, the Shenandoah tied up in Liverpool, England.
In addition to these victories, the Confederacy claimed responsibility for several new naval technologies during the Civil War. One was the first modern submarine. This ship was 10 meters long. It sank 4 times while being tested. It was raised each time and put back into service. One night, it fired its torpedoes at a much larger Union ship and sank it. But the explosion was so great that it tore apart the submarine, and it sank too. The Confederacy also developed very effective underwater explosive devices for use in the harbors.
Even with its victories and technologies, however, the Confederacy could not stop the Union Navy. The Union Navy was bigger to begin with and grew much faster. During the first 2 years of the Civil War, the Union captured several southern ports, Fort Hatteras and Roanoke Island, North Carolina, Port Royal, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, and perhaps most importantly, New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans lay near the mouth of the Mississippi River. It was the largest city in the South. It was the largest seaport. It had become a busy industrial center, producing war equipment for Confederate forces. If the Union could capture New Orleans, it would control the Mississippi River. President Lincoln appointed Navy officer David Farragut to lead the attack on New Orleans.
To reach the city, Farragut had to sail his ships past 2 Confederate forts on the Mississippi River. He shelled the forts for 6 days and nights, but the forts were so strong that the shells caused little damage. He decided not to wait any longer. One dark night, Farragut led 17 Union warships up the river in a line. The Confederate forces heard them and began to fire. One ship was sunk. 3 others were damaged so badly that they could not continue. But 13 made it safely past the forts. When Farragut reached New Orleans, he found the city defenseless. Several thousand Confederate soldiers had fled. They knew they could not defend against the bigger Union force. Only civilians remained. Farragut captured New Orleans without a fight. The Confederate flag was lowered, and the United States flag was raised over the city.
Several weeks before Farragut captured New Orleans, a new kind of Navy battle was fought off Hampton Roads, Virginia. It was the first battle between iron ships. On the Confederate side was the Virginia. It had been built from what remained of a captured Union warship called the Merrimack. The Virginia was like no other warship ever seen in the world. It was 80 meters long. The part that showed above the waterline was built of wood 60 centimeters thick. This part was covered with sheets of iron 10 centimeters thick. 10 windows were cut into it. Behind each window was a cannon. In a battle, the windows would open, the cannons would fire, and the windows would close again. At the front was a sharp point of iron that could smash through the sides of wooden ships. The Virginia could not move fast, and it was difficult to control. It took almost 30 minutes to turn around. Still, there seemed to be no way to stop this iron monster. It already had destroyed 2 Union warships, and it was coming back for more.
The Union ship chosen to fight the Virginia was the Monitor. It, too, was covered with iron, but it was much smaller than the Virginia, and it carried only 2 cannons. These 2 cannons, however, were on a part of the ship that could turn in a complete circle. They could be aimed in any direction. The Monitor and the Virginia faced each other on the morning of March 9th, 1862. They moved in close, very close, then began to fire. A Confederate cannonball hit the iron side of the Monitor and bounced away. Union sailors cheered. The cannons of the Virginia could do no damage. But the Union sailors soon discovered that their cannons could do no damage either.
The men inside the 2 ships suffered from noise, heat, and smoke. The roar of their own cannons was extremely loud. Even louder was the crash of enemy cannonballs and explosive shells on the iron walls. Some of the men suffered burst eardrums. At least one man was struck unconscious from the force of a cannonball against the iron. The men quickly learned to stay away from the walls. Smoke from the cannons filled the ships. Then it floated out over the water. At times, the 2 ships could not see each other.
The Virginia and the Monitor fought for 3 hours. Neither ship scored an important hit. Neither suffered serious damage. Then the cannons of the Virginia fell silent. The Confederate ship had used up its gunpowder. It also had used up much of its fuel. It was lighter now and was floating higher in the water. A well-aimed cannonball could hit below its iron covering and sink it. The Confederate captain decided to withdraw. The Union captain, too, was ready to break off the battle. He decided not to follow. Neither ship could claim victory. But the Monitor had kept the Virginia from destroying more of the Union's wooden warships. The Virginia itself was to live just 2 more months. Union forces seized the Confederate Navy base at Norfolk, where the Virginia was kept. And the Iron Monster was sunk to keep it from falling into Union hands.
The battle at Hampton Roads between the Virginia and the Monitor was undecisive. It did not have much effect on the final result of America's Civil War. But it was still an important battle, for it marked the beginning of the end of the world's wooden navies.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.